We're looking at something that is so vital to our being the aroma of Christ that if you don't get the connection, you'll miss the point and you'll miss the power that He has for you. We've been looking at one section and noticing this is the first one. This section here, 2 Corinthians 2:14 through 6:1. Now we had you bracket that. We had you bracket it so you could see this is the core of the 2 Corinthian letter. This core, I'm convinced, is the Holy Spirit's handbook on personal ministry. How many of you are full-time ministers for Christ? Let me see your hands. Full-time ministers. Well, that's about 80% of us. That's pretty good. But if your life is your ministry, guess what? We're all full-time ministers. We noticed last Sunday the statement, all of these three or four Sundays that we've been trying to get out of this subject of being, and yet I can't seem to get out of it. We're going to be in it again today. But it's so essential that we recognize that unless we are something, we're not going to do what we need to do. Unless we are. He calls us to be before He calls us to ever work, before He calls us to do. Not that we have to be totally before we start, but we've got to become, something has got to happen to us. Now what we looked at last Sunday was what had to happen to us. If you'll turn quickly to 2 Corinthians chapter 3 verses 4 through 6, this is what we noticed last Sunday. And I want us to emphasize it again, 2 Corinthians chapter 3 verses 4 through 6. And we worked out of and referenced Jeremiah 31:31 through 34 and contrasted the old covenant with the new covenant. Do you remember that? Well, listen to this. Such confidence as this is ours through Christ before God. Not that we're competent of ourselves to claim anything for ourselves, but our competence comes from God. Listen to this. He has made us competent as ministers of a new covenant, a new agreement. Not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. Now that was the personal point that we need to discuss. And we did it last week. We contrasted the difference between the old covenant and the new covenant. You remember that? The old covenant had to do with what was written on tables of stone, and people were brought into that covenant at what age? Men were brought into it at what age? 8 days. At 8 days old, they were circumcised and brought into the covenant. Something done to them by somebody else, without their knowledge, without their assent, their consent, that was the old covenant. So that whenever the census taker came and said, "What are you by religion?" I'm a Jew. I was circumcised the 8th day of the tribe of Benjamin or whatever. That's the old covenant. They spent the rest of their lives, the major task of the Jewish nation under this old covenant was to spend whatever time it took to get the people who were already in that covenant to know who the God was in whose covenant they were. They didn't know who He was. They didn't know anything about it. So the old covenant got it reversed in the sense that they became part of the covenant and then later on learned why. The new covenant isn't like that. The new covenant, He says in Jeremiah 31:31, "This is the covenant that I'm going to make with their children, with the house of Israel after those days," says the Lord. "I will write My laws" where? "On their heart. And I will engrave it upon their minds. And they will no longer teach every man his brother, saying, 'Know the Lord.'" They're going to all know Me. Because there won't be any covenant without people knowing why they're there. Now, are you okay with that? You understand that? And I said that the major theological disruption came when, back about Constantine's time or a little bit before, they began to revert to that Old Testament dynamic, the Old Covenant dynamic, as they took little babies and sprinkled them and brought them into what they believed was the Christian religion. They reverted to the old dynamic, and you just can't do that, not expecting people then to be the aroma of Christ. So I want you to understand that last Sunday, we talked about the difference between something that someone else commits you to and something that you commit yourself to. And there's all the difference between night and day. And the old covenant, he says, it is no longer in force. And 700 years before the new covenant made its appearance, he said, I'm going to change things. It will be a new covenant. It will not be like that old covenant. Okay, do you understand? That's what was the personal application of this text that we are in this morning in 2 Corinthians. He has made us ministers, or competent as ministers of a new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. Now today, we're going to look at a broader application of that, and I'm going to have to ask you to do some serious creative thinking. I'm not sure I can get this to you. I'm not sure we'll have, I don't know. But you've got to help me. Thank you for praying for me. I've struggled with this. I've laid it aside. I've revised it 5 times. I still am not confident that we'll get, but listen, if what was said last Sunday is not understood, then individually we won't make it. Until it's heart upon heart, until it's His Spirit upon our spirit, until you come like Tevye, who wanted to know if his wife, Golda, loved him, until you come to the place where you can actually fall in love with God and say, I'm here because I want to be, I'm here because I love you, I'm here to stay, pierce my ear, I'll serve no other God. Then today, if we don't understand what we're talking about today, and I'm going to say this up front, and it may shock you, and I may, but I'll say it later, unless we understand what we're talking about today and what this text talks about today, our movement is history. The churches of Christ will not last unless we understand what he's talking about here today. But you've got to help me get through this. Let's think about it, just a few things then in light of that. But this is what we're working off of. And it's this, the being that we've been talking about. We're going to wait till you kids get back for the having so that you'll know what you have as members of this new covenant. Now, in the first century, there were lots of different kinds of people. Of course, there were Jews. That's where Christianity was born, in the womb of Judaism. There were Jews who were called Judean Jews. They were the ones who lived in and around Jerusalem, in the land of Judah. They were the Bible Belt Jews. They were the ones who had it all together. They were the ones that were the strict ones. You had those Jews. Then you had Grecian Jews. And these were the ones that had been kind of tainted. They were all over this whole world, all over the whole Mediterranean world. And they'd been tainted. They used a different Old Testament. They used the Septuagint. It was a Greek translation made in Alexandria, Egypt, about 300 B.C. That was there. That was what they spoke. They spoke Greek. And so there were the Jews themselves and around Judea. And then there were the Grecian Jews who lived all over the whole world. Virtually the whole world. There were Jews everywhere. And then you had proselytes. You had proselytes who were from all over these places here, and they had been converted to Judaism. Proselytes. There were two of those. Proselytes of the gate and proselytes of righteousness. One of these accepted circumcision, kosher food, the whole smear. They accepted it all. The others were more or less just attachments who respected Judaism and kept it somewhat. And then there were Gentiles. They were people, Greeks, Romans, Phoenicians, you name it. They were all these people here who lived in all these different nations. They were the Gentiles. They were not Jews. But Christianity impacted and came in and interfaced with not only the Jews and the proselytes, but it interfaced with these Gentile people from all different nations. And then you've got Hebrews, some more Hebrews, who had become Christians but who were tempted to go back into Judaism. They had come out of it, but they were tempted to go back into Judaism, partly because of the persecution that was facing them, that they were involved in, they were suffering, and partly because another class of people were tinkering and tampering and tempting them, and they were the Judaizing teachers who had been converted from Judaism to Christianity, but they had not been able to get free from the law. And they were insisting that you and I, all Gentiles who wanted to come to Christ, they were insisting that we all keep the law of Moses, essentially saying you've got to be a Jew before you can become a Christian. Now, with this mix of all these different kinds of people, Jews, proselytes, Judean Jews, Grecian Jews, Jews having to go back, wanting to go back under the law, all of these different kinds of people generated a similar mix of literature. As the apostles wrote to these various churches, some were purely Gentile, some were purely Jewish, some were mixed. As this great mix of congregations developed, a general mix of literature developed. Now, we won't have time to go into what goes where, except to tell you that the most predominant body of literature was directed toward those churches out here where these Jewish Christians had gone and were causing all this trouble. And they were telling us Gentiles, if you're going to be a real Christian, if you're going to accept our Messiah, you've got to accept our law. They nearly sank the ship of Zion in the very first century. Christianity almost did not survive the first century because of these Judaizing teachers. Now, do you remember how many books we said last week, I think, how many letters were written to address this problem? There were 13. I'm just going to read them off. The letter in Acts 15 that was sent to all Gentile churches. Acts as a whole records the struggle. Romans, 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, and Colossians address it directly, head on. Indirectly, 1 Corinthians, Philippians, 1 Thessalonians, 1 Timothy, and Titus, and then the book of Hebrews was a head-on address to the Hebrew people who had become Christians but were now wanting to go back and get away from the persecution. Now, I don't want to lose you, but what's the problem? The last group, as I said, posed the greatest threat to Christianity in the first century. The Jewish church, and hear me on this, the Jewish church, which dug its heels in and said, we're not going that way. They refused to accept the mandate from God that the Messiah was intended for everybody. Jew, Gentile, black, white, slave, free, male, female. The gospel was to be given to everybody. The Jewish people who had become Christians but had failed to see this and had failed to acknowledge that the gospel really was for everybody and that you did not have to become a Jew to become a Christian. The Jewish Christians who dug their heels in and said, we're not going that way. You're not going to bring them stinking Gentiles in here and mess up something good. Because they never could accept the fact that there were going to be Christians who did not look exactly like them. The Jewish church of the first century stumbled over the stumbling stone. They stumbled over it. They refused to acknowledge the fact that there were going to be Christians that didn't look like them. They didn't dress like them. They were uncircumcised. All the Jewish Christians had been circumcised as Jews. Here come these Gentiles. They hadn't been circumcised. They didn't keep a kosher table. They didn't keep a beard. They shaved. The Gentiles were clean shaven. The Jewish, you know what the Gentiles said about the Jewish people? There was a difference in the way they smelled. The Jewish Christian said, oh, the Gentiles smell like fish. To the Gentile, the Jewish people smelled like butter. But they were just all so different. And the Jewish Christian just simply said, I cannot accept that. But let me tell you what, those Jewish churches who dug their heels in and said, we're not going to let Gentiles in here unless they become like us Jews. By the end of the first century, the ones who dug their heels in and said, we don't care what you're saying, Paul. We don't care what you think is the ultimate end of Christianity. We're not going to go that route. And so they maintained their separateness. They maintained their elevated nose as they looked down on us Gentiles and said, no, we're not going to let you in unless you become like us. Now in the first century, whether we've realized it or not, there were two denominations in the first century. At least, there were Jewish Christians and there were Gentile Christians, and pretty well they had separate churches because they just simply could not pull off this bringing of a legalistic mind, the mind of the law that held on to the law. They could not bring themselves to believe that they must turn loose of that. Or even not even turn loose of it, but just not bind it on everybody else. They said, no, we're not going to go that route. Now, why am I telling you all this? You say, where in the world are you going? I'm telling you this for this simple reason. The movement, and I've prayed about this, and I've struggled over it. The movement of which we are a part, the movement in which most of you older people were brought up in, myself included, are virtually parallel to that Jewish church in the first century. Well, let me make sure I don't leave you hanging. And I don't want you to accept, to think what I'm saying is, it is critical. I understand it is critical of us. But the situation that we're finding ourselves in today, not only is, it's not just critical in the sense of being critical, it's crucial. There is a smell of death in our movement today. And you young people, you students, you know what I'm talking about. You know where some of your fellow students, you know what they've done with it. We'll look at it in a few minutes, but you know what they've done. They've gone. Okay, what is the call? What's the problem? Turn, if you will, into your text. Turn to 2 Corinthians 3:14a and 3:15, those two verses there. Let's just look at it quickly. 3:14a says, but their minds were made dull. The problem with the first century Jewish Christian or the first century Jew who had not become a Christian, but the first century Jew, their minds had become dulled. They could not understand that there was a new covenant in place. And then verse 15 makes the statement, even to this day when Moses is read, a veil covers their hearts. A veil covers their hearts. They were blind to it. Whenever the law of Moses was read, well, listen, that's the only scriptures that the church in the first century had. Until finally, letters began to be written and things began to be set in place. But the only scriptures they had was the Old Testament. And you can see why when these Jewish teachers would come in among Christians who were Gentiles and they were quoting out of the Old Testament, that's the only scriptures that there were. They couldn't say, but now Paul said in Romans and Paul said in 2 Corinthians, there wasn't any Romans. There wasn't any 2 Corinthians. The problem was that the Jewish people who were under the law wouldn't turn loose of the law and enjoy the freedom that's in Jesus Christ out from under the bondage of the law. There was a veil covering the Jewish eyes whenever it's read, Paul says in 3:15. And there came a curse with it. You know what the curse was? The curse of the law, the curse that came with the veil over the face of those people, was simply that they couldn't keep it. They could not keep the law. Consequently, they lived under a constant cloud of guilt because they couldn't keep the law. Look, if you will, he quotes in Galatians 3:10. Turn back to Galatians, the book that is written primarily. Turn on over to Galatians. It's written directly. It's the most direct polemic against this kind of thinking, where you have to keep the law, where you have to be circumcised, where you have to do all of this. In Galatians 3:10, listen to what it says. All who rely on observing the law are under a curse. For it is written, cursed is everyone who does not continue to do everything written in the book of the law. He's quoting Leviticus 18 and verse 5. That's the historical setting. That's what bothered the first century Christians. That's what nearly tore the church apart in the first century. Do you know what the current application of that is? What is the current application? The historical application was that the churches in the first century were being ripped asunder because there were Judaizing teachers coming in and saying, you've got to keep the law of Moses. And we have been blindsided by only looking at the historical application of it and have ignored or been unaware of the current application. Do you know what the current application of that principle is to us today? It's not the law of Moses. It is the legalism that is represented by those who insisted on keeping the law. It's the bringing of making a book of Leviticus into the New Testament. There is no Leviticus, someone has said. There is no book of Leviticus in the New Testament. Our misstep, our blindness, is that we have taken the New Covenant and have looked at it through the eyes of the Old Covenant. We have looked at the New Covenant as though it were the Old Covenant, just with different dress on it. But the same dynamic. And here was the dynamic of the Old. You have got to keep every single thing in the law, or else you're damned. You're cursed. That was the dynamic. If you do it, you'll live by it. But cursed is everybody that doesn't. In the current age, there aren't the Jews to deal with, really. There's not the law of Moses to deal with. But there is that dynamic that says this: unless you get everything right, you've had it. We're not having a thing. You and I don't have it. You know, you've got some things about you that trouble me. You know, can you accept this, that it's all right to not always be right? Do you have to always be right in order to be right with God? Well, you think about it. You know who that excludes? It excludes the one speaking to you. I'm not right in everything. It excludes every one of you listening because you're not right in everything. But you know what you've done, what we have done? We have looked down our nose like Jesus taught in the Pharisee and the publican who went up to pray. And we thank God that we're not like everybody else. Extortioners, adulterers, or even like this tax collector back here. I'm so glad I'm not like him. I fast twice a week. I eat the Lord's Supper every Lord's Day. I give a tithe. No, forget that one. But we've looked down our nose at people who are not exactly like us. And we have treated them in the very way that the Jewish Christians of the first century treated us Gentiles, because we were not exactly like them. And here we are today. And unless we stop that, I think we're on the road to eventual death. That's the problem. The problem is that we have failed to recognize that the law is not really, that's not our problem. Not the law in the sense of the law proper. But it's in taking the New Covenant and looking at it through the lens of the Old Covenant that says you've got to get everything just exactly right. And there's a curse that has followed that one. What is the curse that has been attached to that kind of mindset in the churches of Christ? The curse that follows it is an almost abysmal amount of division, discord, discouragement, pride, all of it. And you talk about divisions. I've written a few of them down here. I've written a few just for you to think about it, and I'm embarrassed to read these. We've divided over communion cups, whether we're going to have many like we have today or have to have one. We've divided over that years ago. We've divided over kitchens, whether you can have one or not, race, whether you're black or white, or we are divided over ritual, over contribution, whether you can use it and how you can use it, over cooperation, over organs, over orphans, over classes, over clapping. You say, surely we haven't spent our time there. Oh, yeah. You bet we've spent our time and much of our energy wrangling over these. And do you know how many different official divisions there are in America today? You know about how many? About 24. 24 who don't speak to each other, who don't acknowledge one another, who don't fellowship one another. 24. That's the curse that has come through looking at the new covenant through the eyes of the law, where you have to have everything exactly right. And right meaning you have to have everything exactly like I'm doing it. What's the solution? First of all, admit that legalism is a total failure. It's totally futile. It didn't work then. It doesn't work today. Look, if you will, turn to Galatians 3:11 and watch what he says. Look at verse 10. All who rely on observing the law are under a curse. For it is written, cursed is everyone who does not continue to do everything written in the book of the law. Clearly, no one is justified before God by the law. Because the righteous will live by faith. The law is not based on faith. On the contrary, the man who does these things will live by them. Christ redeemed us from that. We'll come to that in just a second. But first of all, admit that legalism is a total failure. It's totally futile. Now, look, if you will, at Acts 15, verses 9 through 11. This is the watershed in Acts 15, 9 through 11. This is where the decision was finally made. You see, this thing was such a problem that they had to go to Jerusalem to the apostles, and they called a general conference. It was a problem that was threatening to destroy this great movement that Jesus began. And so it got to be so bad, Peter was even sucked into it. He was even sucked back into it up in Antioch of Syria. You remember when he was up there and he had been eating with Gentiles? Man, he's enjoying that bacon and ham and all that pork. And then when some of these Judaizing teachers came down from Jerusalem, came down to Antioch, you know what he did? He wiped his chin off and stood back away from those Gentile brothers. And Paul saw it and said, I nailed him to the wall. I confronted him to his face. Here's what came out of that. The 15th chapter of Acts, beginning with verse 11. Verse 9. This is Paul writing now to Galatian Christians. He made no distinction between us and them. That is, between the Jews and the Gentiles. He made no distinction. For he purified their hearts by faith. Now then, why do you try? Listen to this. He was talking to those people who were trying to do this. Why do you try to test God by putting on the necks of the disciples, that is, of the Gentiles' disciples, a yoke that neither we nor our fathers have been able to bear? No. We believe it is through the grace of our Lord Jesus that we are saved, just as they were. So you see, that's where the watershed took place in Acts, the 15th chapter, and it should have been settled forever. But we've resurrected it, and blindly so, because we say, oh, we know that we're not under the law of Moses. Yes, but we have never did see the fact that it's not the law of Moses. The problem isn't there. The problem lies in our not seeing the difference or that the same dynamic that worked under the law of Moses that condemned them. We have hauled it out of there and brought it over into the new covenant, and we're looking at the new covenant of grace through this same law, and it nullifies grace if you've got to be right in everything before you can be right with God. If we do not come to grips with this one issue, it's not only dividing us among ourselves, but it's divided us from everybody else in the world who loves Jesus Christ, who's come to Him in faith, who has been immersed into Him. My place is either the new birth has taken place or it hasn't. If the new birth has taken place, then you're my brother. It either is or it isn't. You're either in the kingdom or you're not in the kingdom. If the new birth has not taken place, then you're not in the kingdom. Admit that legalism is totally futile. It's evident that no one is justified before God by the law. You just can't do it. They couldn't do it. We can't do it. But neither can anybody do it who's trying to use legalism as the lens through which to look at the Christian covenant. Second is, Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law. He has bought us back out of that mess. He has bought us, it says. This is in 13 of Galatians 3. He has redeemed us from the curse of the law. In other words, let me just translate that into our terms today. He has saved us from having to get everything right before we're all right with God. He saved us from that. If he hadn't, nobody would be right with God. That's the difference. That's what the new covenant is about. You don't have to stand under the curse of damnation because you didn't do everything exactly right. You just don't have. He has redeemed us from that. So that's the solution. He's the solution. Now what happens is, He becomes the lens through which we look at everything. We start looking at everything through the lens of Jesus Christ. Here's the problem with us today. If you don't have Jesus Christ as your anchor, you'll go as wild as a buck and you'll be as unpredictable as a March hare. When people leave legalism and come out into the freedom that's in Jesus Christ, unless you make Jesus Christ your anchor. As long as He's your anchor, you're not going to get very far wrong. There was a man over in College Station, Texas. Very, very conservative man. I mean, he just was so conservative. And you know what? I hope the grace of God will cover him. But what he was, I called him up one day and I said, "Let's eat. Let me take you up for a hamburger." Well, it surprised him. And he said, okay. So we made an appointment, set the phone down. It wasn't 5 minutes that he called me back. And he said, "I can't eat with you." Now this man was a member of a church that had a sign out front that said Church of Christ. They ate the Lord's Supper every Lord's Day. They believed in the deity of Christ. They baptized people to become members of the body. They did all these things. But you know what? They were sitting over here, one thing that he just couldn't swallow. And as a result, he excluded me. And it was whether or not you could have communion cups. I think it was one or many. Hello? Or it may have been over the fact that they didn't have classes and we did. I'm not sure what exactly it was. But it was one of those things that are so far removed from the cross of Jesus Christ that it's almost undetectable. But he had detected it and he had seen that I didn't detect it, and consequently he wasn't about to eat with me and be seen with me. And we're doing all this arguing. We've done all this arguing for all these years while the world is going to hell. We have done all this majoring in minors, leaving undone and leaving unnoticed those two things that Jesus says are the characteristics that determine your being my disciples. If you love each other, and if you're united so the world can know it. And we have insisted on all this other, and we've divided into all these 24 different groups because of the fact that we've failed to see that the dynamic of the old, we've brought it over into the new and have made it just another law that says you've got to have everything just like I am, or else you've had it. I'm not about to be with you. And we've got to stop it.